Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Gichigame Hearts, Stories and Histories from Masabi Kong, by Linda Lagarde Grover, narrated by Lanisha Edmonds. And so Elias joined his true love Victoria, and they joined the others who watch us from far beyond where the sun sets, the past that birthed the present, that even now births the future. They pray as we pass into life. They pray us through our lives. They pray us as we pass out of life. When we die, they pray our steps across the walk west. Thus, blessed, we live and die in the air hung with their prayers, the breath of their words on our faces and bodies, their spirits among us, trying to see and hear and understand. Wegonin, what it is, we think. Amunji dosh, and I wonder. We ponder this all of our lives, not realizing what we already know. Our tent skelet. Part of a massive ridge of gabbro rock that extends southwest of Duluth and follows the north shore of Lake Superior into Canada. The point of rocks divides the city of Duluth in half. The area around Duluth has been known by Ojibwe words that describe this terrain. One of these is Onigamising, the place of the small portage, which refers to the 5-mile-long sandbar not far from the point of rocks. Another is Masabi Kong, the place of giants. Standing on top of those walls of gabbro, or looking up at the mass of rocks and trees from the valley and lakeshore, we are standing among the giants. In 1838, newlyweds Josepha Susan Negan Ig Ichigokwe and Gabrielle Igomo Laverge traveled from La Pointe, Wisconsin, on Madeline Island, to Fond du Lac, the Ojibwe settlement next to the American fur post on the St. Louis River in Minnesota. Their first child, Angelique, was born in 1839 at the Fond du Lac settlement, in sight of the gabbro ridge before there was a Duluth, or a state of Minnesota, before the lands of the Minnesota Arrowhead were lost under the terms of the 1854 treaty. That baby girl lived to be an old woman. Angelique's children and grandchildren scattered under federal removals and relocations, and became part of the Boys Fort, Fond du Lac, and Grand Portage bands. She died in the West End neighborhood, in sight of the western side of the Point of Rocks, and is buried in the Park Hill Cemetery, next to her husband, a Civil War veteran. During her lifetime, Angelique had moved from one end of Duluth to the other, never far from the gabbro ridge and the Point of Rocks. We, the descendants, are of this land and story, and this land and story are of us. We are honored to live in this place of the giants. Part 1. Point of Rocks. Gabbro. Here in Onigamising, Duluth, Minnesota, the small city on the western tip of Lake Superior, a massive outcropping of gabbro rock, the Point of Rocks, divides the city in half. Never far from that uneven and rocky hill that affords views of Lake Superior to the east and to the west of Point Park Peninsula and Lake Superior Harbor, to St. Louis Bay and then the St. Louis River. We, Onigamising Gowin Ninigwag, native and non-native, live surrounded by beauty created by the Great Spirit, the Creator, through the ages. This is both our history and our existence today. Onigamising is known by a few names besides that of Daniel Gray Saloon, Sir Duluth, the French explorer who arrived at this end of Lake Superior in 1679. Like other Europeans who made their way to the interior, he was looking for something, Many were looking for areas rich in natural resources that could be harvested, especially furs. But I believe that a desire for peace and quiet, beauty, and setting foot on a land that other Europeans had never seen was also part of the quest. It is doubtful that he was surprised to find that there were already people living here. The Ojibwe, who had themselves journeyed from the northeast coastal regions, from what is now northern New England, into Canada and Newfoundland. During the Great Migration of the Ojibwe, there were a number of places where people stopped and stayed, all spiritual and sacred because of their creation by the Great Spirit, the Creator, who sent the visions and dreams directing the journey. When Sir Duluth reached what is now the Fond du Lac neighborhood of far western Duluth, that place was already home to an established Ojibwe community. My ancestors, my father's grandparents, and generations preceding them had traveled from the east on a route that followed the Great Lakes to Sault Ste. Marie, on the far eastern end of Lake Superior where it joins Lake Huron. Some families continued westward to La Pointe, the Ojibwe community on Madeline Island in Wisconsin, and some went further to Fond du Lac at the western end of Lake Superior. Others traveled northward from Sault Ste. Marie to Fort Frances, Ontario, and then south to Grand Portage, which is 150 miles northeast of present-day Duluth, and to the Boys Fort on Lake Vermilion in northern Minnesota. At Fond du Lac, the Laverges and Lagardes established lives and extended families that experienced upheavals, removals, returns, the breaking up of families, and the reconnection of families, as when my great-grandmother Lucy Ann married McQuay Mudd and began their dynasty at Boys Fort, and when my grandmother Victoria and grandfather Elias, both students at Vermilion Lake Indian School near Tower, Minnesota, met and joined families that had known and lived with one another for a long time before European contact. From the Point of Rocks, the view northeastward of Lake Superior stretches for many miles and fades into a horizon of lake and sky, and southwestward to the Harbor Bay and the St. Louis River, where the waters narrow and the view fades to a gray-blue mist with outlines that cannot be clearly identified. I squint and think, there it is, Fond du Lac, I think that is it, and recall times I have been there. The local 106 Painters Union picnics when I was a little girl, the dam, the fur post historical marker, and times and events that occurred before my time on Earth, but that I feel just the same. Not far from the base of Point of Rocks is a 5-mile-long peninsula, Park Point, a natural sandbar that separates lake and natural harbor. The old Ojibwe and fur traders traveling by canoe portaged across the sandbar on their way to, among other places, the American Fur Company Post, built in 1808 on Fond du Lac and abandoned in 1847. The shortest, easiest point to portage was close to today's downtown and Canal Park, a stretch of only about 2 blocks. Onigamising refers to that place. The word translates in English to the place of the small portage. Another locative word of the Duluth area is Masabikong, the place of giants, which identifies the large ridge above the area out of which emerges the Point of Rocks. I have heard that the word Masabikong might have referred specifically to the Point of Rocks in the past, but have not been able to verify that in stories from our Ojibwe tradition. It is interesting, I think, that American Indian names and words for places seem to be descriptive of the notable natural area, while so many American English names for places bear a specific person's name, for example, Duluth. I betcha if you asked anybody in Duluth where the Point of Rocks is, you'd get a different answer from each person, my husband commented as we drove around the area one afternoon, to see if there might be specific natural boundaries. As we passed the outcropping off West First Street, where for many years a large Tasty Bread sign overlooked Garfield Avenue, Rice's Point, and the Blatnick Bridge, a.k.a. the High Bridge, I answered, "I bet you're right." We both speak the same language because we are from the West End and West Duluth. For me, the Point of Rocks is bounded by two avenues that ascend curving up each side from the bottom, Superior Street, to the top of the hill, holding the outcropping between them like a pair of cupped hands. Although the Gabbro Formation is a good mile and a half wide at the top, on Michigan Street it is just a few blocks in width. For nearly a century and a half, there has been a small settlement in a scooped-out area that is usually called Glen Place, and has its own story within the history of the Duluth area. The Italian immigrant community that lived there called the settlement Piedmont, after their homeland. Originally, both of the avenues that wrapped the outcropping were named Piedmont II, and eventually the eastern one was renamed Masaba Avenue, while the western one kept the name Piedmont Avenue. Greenery grows from the cracks and spaces of the Point of Rocks, where the rock has eroded or split and soil has blown in. Here, since long before the Ojibwe, long before the native people who lived here before the Ojibwe, certainly long before Duluth, and longer than that, even before the glacier that covered this place 10,000 years ago, before the glacier melted and the area was covered by water and there was no surface land or small portage at all, the outcropping has seen a great many stories and knows a great many secrets. Our Ojibwe and, in a broader sense, Anishinaabe history is a layering of our stories over that land and lakescape, and our traditional teachings that encourage us to strive for a life of balance are a reflection of that. Point of Rocks, surely an intended work of the Creator for our natural world, may not have been intended as a separation, so much as a tangible fulcrum of hope for balanced lives across and throughout Oniga Miseng's neighborhoods. The Point of Rocks bears scars from two attempted blastings, one during the 1870s exploration for gold and minerals, and then again during World War I, the second time an attempt to straighten out Superior Street. Both were unsuccessful, even futile, but the breaking up of the Gabbro created by the search for gold created a small valley scooped out at the bottom of the outcropping. The Italian immigrants who came to Duluth in the early 20th century settled in the lush greenness of the valley, sheltered somewhat on three sides from the iciness of the northern winter wind. That valley, neatly contained between Superior Street and First Street, was called Little Italy, and later the Hollow, and Glen Place, or the Glend, a neighborhood that expanded up the hill as it grew. As part of the urban renewal programs of the 1960s, the houses in the Glen were purchased and most were torn down. Apartment buildings rose up on the Superior Street entrance, but much of the rest of the Glen has continued to return to greenery and rock. Today, the area above the Glen, the West Hillside, is anchored to the geography and history of Duluth, as we all are, by that massive outcropping of Gabbro and the lifeblood of the Piedmont descendants who built roads, homes, schools, and churches. Here in Oniga Miseng, most of the neighborhoods in our 13-by-3-mile city abut the lake, or are within a mile or two of water. Many of our poorest areas have million-dollar views of Lake Superior. Across that 13 miles, some of us live east of the Point of Rocks, some west, some in the apartment buildings that have been built in the Glen, and some perched above the mass of Gabbro and greenery. We live within sight and shadow of the terrain that has demonstrated a strength far beyond mankind's pitiful tinkerings, an immovable and imponderable beauty that will continue to exist, with its stories and secrets, in the animate state in which the Ojibwe people and language regard asin, or stone. The old Ojibwe used to say that a long time ago the people and the animals could talk with one another. Perhaps even longer ago, the people could communicate with the trees and plants, with the water, and also with the stones. And perhaps that is one reason why, in the Ojibwe language, the stone is considered to be animate. Perhaps the stones still do speak, but we don't hear or understand. An old story. There is a story about the point of rocks I heard some time ago, one of life's mysteries that might be cleared up and understood if the Gabbro would speak and was willing to tell me, which it might do someday. The story takes place in fairly recent times and is not one of the old stories of the creation of the earth, yet I feel that it must tie in with those stories. Its brevity generates wonderment and a human desire to know, in Ojibwe fashion. The listener and reader practice the virtue of realizing that knowledge is not there just for the pursuing, that if our understanding is meant to be, it will happen when it should. And yet, in our pitiful way, we cannot help but wonder. It goes like this. One of the times the rock was being blasted, near where the Bethel Society building is today between Superior and First Streets, a large crack opened and an Anishinaabe man dressed in old-style clothes stepped out. He looked all around him, then walked away. Just walked away. Dashmisa ihwa nungum. And that is all there is for now. Bimo Sewin. From the Bethel to the Union Gospel Mission. Duluth's First Street passes through many neighborhoods that are diverse in their buildings, financial resources, and histories. Bisecting Masaba Avenue, First Street winds westward around the natural formations of Gabbro until it reaches Duluth's West End, and then continues for miles, sometimes straight, sometimes curved, and even interrupted, through the western neighborhoods. Eastward, First Street lies in a straight line through the downtown and central and east hillside neighborhoods, and finally to Duluth's East End. Much of Duluth's street life has been concentrated for more than a century on the 10-block stretch of downtown First Street, between the Union Gospel Mission near 3rd Avenue East and the Bethel near 8th Avenue West. Both street missions were founded by Duluth religious and civic leaders to provide a place to sleep, a meal, a prayer service, and some social services for the Great Lakes seamen, lumberjacks, and other transient men. Today, I suppose, they no longer require a prayer service before food and rest. The populations they serve have expanded, and they work with other governmental social service entities, but they still provide faith-based services. The Bethel building was built in 1912, a three-story L-shaped building that faces northeast toward Lake Superior and the North Shore. A few years ago, the long, dark amber light at its apex, a beacon meant to guide rough men from the freighters and streets to a meal, a religious service, a wash-up, and a bed, was restored. The Union Gospel Mission, founded in 1922, began in a storefront building on 2nd Avenue East. The mission moved down the block and across the street to a larger space 20 years ago, but the original building stands, looking more run down, but otherwise not much changed from October 1970, when the minister sent us a sympathy card after my grandfather was found fallen in an alley nearby and brought to the hospital, where he died of pneumonia. The minister wrote in the card that he knew my grandfather and was sorry that he passed. It was a kind thing to do and so normal-seeming. A card sent to a family whose grandfather had died? Our grief was complicated and lasted a long time, through to today and as long as anyone will remember him. As we, his descendants with those memories, age and pass, those memories will pass too, which calls up another kind of grief. I sometimes picture time as a slide rule, dates and lives coinciding and paralleling as we move that mathematical tool back and forth, past to present, understanding groupings, sets, and patterns, but not quite how it all fits together. The Bethel Society was formed around the time of the first attempted blasting of the Point of Rocks. The Bethel building opened for business the same year Uncle Bob was born in Chippewa City, an Ojibwe community 1.5 miles northeast of Grand Marais, Minnesota, on the shore of Lake Superior. By 1922, when the Union Gospel Mission opened, Bob and his little brothers were at the Indian boarding school in Red Lake, Minnesota, and their parents had moved from the Grand Portage Reservation to Duluth after their house burned down. My grandfather, Elias Lagarde, who was born in 1900 and died in 1970, was one of the many men who regularly ate, listened to sermons, cleaned up, and slept at the street missions in the 1950s and 1960s. During my grandfather's time, every day the First Street people wandered between the Gospel Mission and the Bethel. Some lived in rooms above stores downtown. Some were between places and needed a place to eat and sleep. As I remember it, they seemed to know one another. On hot days, they stayed on the shaded side of the street. On cold days, they huddled in doorways, between buildings, or in alleyways, smoking cigarettes if they had them, moving a little and shuffling their feet to stay warm. Occasionally, they panhandled. Not everybody was there every day. Many worked, often seasonal jobs at the scrapyards, on the docks, on the boats. My grandfather spent many of his winters at the county work farm. He could handle horses, my dad said. He learned to play the trumpet at the Pipestone Indian boarding school and traveled for a while with a circus band, where he had been an Indian cowboy and could do rope tricks like Will Rogers, my dad said. There were a lot of businesses and a lot of bars on First Street. Although it was a little shabbier than Superior Street, Duluth's main downtown street, there was a lot going on. My mother's engagement ring came from Guerin Brothers, a jewelry store on First Street since 1907. That was in 1950. In 1997, my daughter married a young man who worked in that jewelry store, which was still owned by the Guerin family. When I was 18, I was hired by the telephone company Northwestern Bell, where I was trained to be a toll/long-distance operator, work that I enjoyed. Whenever my shift ended too late in the evening for the bus, my dad would pick me up. I waited inside the glass doors at Bell, watching for his red truck. At that time of night, I could see men walking west toward the Bethel, or east to the Union Gospel Mission, just a few feet from me, or across the street, passing an office machine company with an Olivetti girl poster in the window. She looked so happy to be able to work on one of those typewriters. My grandfather was one of those men who walked along First Street between the Bethel and the Union Gospel Mission. I never saw him through the glass doors of the Northwestern Bell. At 18, I didn't understand much about our history yet, but knew that there was more to the story. I know now that my grandfather and the other Neegees, the downtown and the West End friends by histories and hearts, walked in the very footsteps of the Anishinaabe man who emerged from the cracks of the Gabbro when it was blown open. Then, in the midst of several semi-dramas and semi-traumas of the young womanhood of the times, I moved to Chicago, then back to Duluth, to Chicago, to Duluth, lost. I was in Duluth when my grandfather died and was able to go to his funeral. 3 years later, I was back on First Street, married, pregnant, and working as a teller at a credit union where our lunch breaks were an hour long, which left time to kill. Most days I took a walk, usually 6 or 8 blocks eastward on First Street toward the Union Gospel Mission, and back, my steps taking me past Northwestern Bell and the new YMCA, several bars, and Guerin Brothers Jewelers, past 2 grocery stores, a bakery, and many small shops where most of the buildings rented rooms or apartments, and past Niji after Niji, who had nowhere in particular to go, and so moved more slowly than me. Occasionally, a Niji would nod at me as though we knew each other, which, in truth, we did. One cloudy lunch break, when I passed by the Union Gospel Mission, I slowed my steps slightly and looked as indirectly and inconspicuously as I could through the sheer curtains that covered the bottom half of the storefront windows. I was not really looking for my grandfather, since he had died 2 years earlier, and yet I was. Inside were 2 long tables and several rows of metal folding chairs, with a few men sitting there, waiting for the Bible reading, then something to eat, I suppose. Meals were free at the Union Gospel Mission, and so were beds, first come, first served, on a nightly basis. In the front half of the first floor, the storefront, men could gather to visit and for some respite from walking the sidewalks on First Street. The concrete always hard on the feet and legs of men who were often tired and discouraged, terribly cold in the winter and burning through the soles of their shoes in the summer. Prayer services at the Union were held in this storefront, and at lunch and supper time food was brought out from the back and set out on a long table. The men ate sitting on the folding chairs. Evenings, those who were going to sleep there were allowed upstairs, where there were rooms with single cots and a washroom where they could clean up and wash their other set of underwear and socks, if they had them, in the sinks. In those days, it seemed that only men ate and slept at the Bethel and the Union Gospel Mission, and so many of them were aging Native men. Where Native women on the streets went for food or a place to sleep was disturbing to think about. There were things that women, desperate for those basics, had to do to obtain them or do without. The clouds moved, unblocking the sun. As my shadow moved across the sheer white curtains, one of the men looked up at the windows. Feeling intrusive, I moved on. Our first daughter was born. We bought a car and a couch with a matching chair, and it was a nice life there in our basement apartment in the West End, on the other side of the Point of Rocks. My husband Tim worked for my dad, who was a painting contractor. I drove him to work on days I wanted the car. One day, I brought him his lunch at the Bethel. When Lagarde Painting was working on a free/volunteer job, a shuffleboard court on the gymnasium floor, Tim was spending the day prepping the concrete floor for the paint. I had dressed our baby girl in her blue polka dot dress and ruffled white bonnet. The gym was dark in contrast to the bright sunlight outside, and I stepped carefully over the areas he had already etched and handed him sandwiches and coffee, telling him I would be sure to get to the electric company to pay our bill before they closed for the day. Back outside, several Nijis leaning against the railing outside the doorway glanced indirectly at me. One nodded politely. They were no doubt thinking, "rich Indian girl," a term from those times that is both loaded and complex. As I buckled the belt across the baby in her blue plastic infant seat and got into our nearly new Pinto, I felt overdressed and overblessed. We headed our separate ways, me luxuriously driving west on First Street to Piedmont Avenue and the West End, the men on foot east to downtown. There is something of the man who walked away from the rock blasting in all of us. Some have been luckier than others since then. There is an Ojibwe word, a niche, that offers the question, why? My aunt told me the word is not used often because it can be construed as disrespectful and even unseemly. But I think it is a
sample complete. Ready to continue?